Hello, everybody, and welcome to a beautiful Thursday morning here in New York. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm very happy to be here with you today. I have a wonderful guest who I'm thrilled to have. His name is Stephen Brooks, and he's from Punta Cana in Costa Rica, and I'll be introducing him and telling you more about him in a little while. I have a wonderful recipe to share with you. But first, I want to just talk to you about some of the things that have been going on in my neck of the woods. First off, there is a wonderful TEDx talk coming up on February 16th. And TEDx Manhattan is an event that is going to be a real informative, wonderful, experiential event to highlight the way that we eat. And there's so many guests that are going to be there. Anne-Marie Colburn is there from the Natural Gourmet School. Ann Cooper is there, who is the lunch lady and, you know, has been working with the Edible Schoolyard and working in Boulder and California, transforming school lunches. There's going to be so many guests there. You can look it up and see who's going to be there. But the wonderful thing is, because seating was limited, it's going to be live streamed in so many different places. And locally here on Long Island, I know it's going to be live streamed at the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington. And it's a free event, and you can come down for any part of the day that you want. The event actually goes from 9:30 in the morning to 5:30 in the afternoon. So it's an all-day talk except for a break for lunch. But it is definitely set to be a great conference. Simultaneously, in the South Bronx, there will be another event with the similar themes, but actually one thing that came out of this TEDx talk this year was a woman was invited to speak from the South Bronx, and for a different reason she was then uninvited, and it sparked a whole conversation on a listserv that I'm a part of. And what came of it was that even within the good food movement that we are all such a part of, there is an underlying inequality that is built in that brings up racial issues and disparity amongst people involved. For instance, one downside of this TEDx talk is that it costs $135 to go, which instantly rules out many people being able to be a part of it. The wonderful part, like I said, is that it can be live streamed for free in so many different places. You can go online for TEDx Manhattan and find out where it is being live streamed near you. It's definitely going to be a great event. But anyway, so they formed another event to happen simultaneously in the South Bronx. And if you go to my website, www.iegreen.com, you will be able to pull up that information and find out where it is and buy tickets. And that event is only $35, so it's a lot more affordable. And I believe that there is even a sliding scale for anyone who can't afford that. They can still come. So it's, you know, pay what you can if you can't afford $35. So it's much more open and will certainly have a different audience makeup, I'm sure, than the TEDx Manhattan, just by the nature of it. So that's going on simultaneously. Also, of course, the Just Food Conference is coming up the end of March, March 29th and March 30th. That's at the Food and Finance High School. That's a great thing. If you haven't yet gotten down to the American Museum of Natural History to see our Global Kitchen exhibit, that's a great exhibit, really worth going to. But the other thing that's happening the day after TEDx, and I'm really excited, is a huge protest that is being organized by 350.org, and the Sierra Club just joined forces to rally down in Washington, D.C. against the Keystone XL pipeline. And this is a really important event to show your support. We need to show President Obama that there are the numbers of people, the thousands and thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people that are willing to come out on a cold winter day to show their support for him really making decisions to protect our climate and climate change. You know, he spoke about that in his inaugural speech, and it was really beautiful. But now we have to hold him to task. I mean, I just heard he appointed, someone from Monsanto's chief executive to the food and to be the secretary of the Food and Drug Administration. So, you know, he keeps making other bad decisions that really disappoint me. And so we really need to show the support. And so there's lots of buses that are being organized. I am helping to organize a bus from Long Island. The first bus is, filling up. We may even need to get a second bus. That's what I'm hoping. I'd love to have two buses from Long Island. We have a group of Stony Brook people coming. We need to see lots of students from Hofstra, CW Post, Adelphi. I mean, you're all out there. We need to get young people, and we need to get the older generation, myself and likewise, to come out and show the president that this pipeline, if it gets approval and goes from the tar sands in Alberta to Canada all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico, it will definitely have catastrophes to the environment. There's no question. I mean, all of these pipelines, they always have leaks. They always destroy the surrounding areas, and we just cannot afford that at this time. We need to be investing in renewable energy. And that's another wonderful initiative that 350.org is pushing, and I would like to encourage everybody to divest in any money that they have invested, to divest in any companies that have to do with fossil fuel. And if we can get our universities, if students can protest on their schools, if alumni can write their schools, since schools have such huge endowments that they are investing, if we can ask them to not invest in fossil fuel companies and invest in renewable energy and innovations for the future, we would really see a big impact and a big change happening. So that's something I want to encourage all of you to take up and get involved with. And it's really important, getting involved is one of the foundations of this country, to have the freedom to be able to demonstrate and show your passions. And it is so easy to just, hide your head in the sand and pretend that everything is just copacetic and it's going to be fine. But the reality is we all have to do something. And, every week I send out my newsletter that has so many ways that you can take action. Signing a petition is really easy, but calling Governor Cuomo, for instance, for anti-fracking, that is big. Calling his office makes a much bigger impact than just signing a petition. New Yorkers Against Anti-Fracking is an organization that is really gaining momentum, along with Food and Water Watch, EcoWatch. There's so many different organizations that you can participate in. But all of these organizations need our help, and we need to show that we care. And if you can't do it for everything, that's okay. Pick one. Pick one issue that you feel passionate about, that you really think is horrible and you would like to see changed, and do something about it. Get involved, because we all have to do our part. Otherwise, it's just not going to happen. Also, I just want to remind everybody that there's many winter farmers markets going on. There's one in Huntington. There's one in Northport. And I know there are many in the city. The Green Market actually, of course, still happens down in Union Square all winter long. So show your support for our local farmers and shop at the local farmers market. So I'd like to share with you, before I invite my guest on, this week's recipe. It's a tofu banh mi sandwich. And banh mi sandwiches are a Vietnamese sandwich that I believe is as common as, the hamburger might be in this country. But my sister was making this sandwich, and she uses chicken, but I think traditionally it's made with pork. But, of course, I wanted to transform this sandwich to be a delicious vegan sandwich. So I did. I used tofu, and then I did it again actually with tempeh as well. And it also can be done with seitan. So really any of those vegetarian alternatives will work really well in this. You want to marinate the tofu first, and I marinated it in a half a teaspoon of garlic powder, a half a teaspoon of onion powder, some olive oil, and some red chili peppers. And I marinated in that for just a little while before I sauteed it. So this is the recipe. You know, there's also another component to the sandwich, like a coleslaw that they make, and that's made with water and sugar and vinegar, carrots, and grated radish. And you can either use daikon or we used red radish because it just looks so beautiful. And you can also see a picture of it. It'll be posted on both the PRN website and on my website, IE Green. So for the slaw, you need a half a cup of water, a quarter cup of organic sugar, a quarter cup of vinegar, a half a cup of grated carrots, and a half a cup of grated radish. And then some, I use some salt flakes on there as well. And you can also put on some red pepper if you'd like. Then for the tofu, as I said, it's one block of tofu, and I use the extra firm tofu. Half a teaspoon of garlic powder, half a teaspoon of onion powder, some olive oil. You'll need some tamari, some hot chili oil. And then for the sandwich, you want to purchase a really nice whole grain baguette or whole grain roll of some sort. You're going to want some mayonnaise, whether you use regular mayonnaise or vegan mayonnaise. Half a cup of fresh cilantro, one cucumber seeded and sliced very thin, and some freshly ground pepper. And so you first make the slaw. You're going to let that marinate for like 30 minutes while you're doing everything else. And you're going to slice the tofu into quarter-inch thick slices. And if you're using tempeh, you also slice it about quarter-inch thick. And for the tofu, you're going to lay it out and pat it dry. Tempeh, of course, does not have it's not soaking in water, so it's already dry, so you don't have to do that. Season the tofu with the garlic powder and onion powder. Did the same thing when I used the tempeh. And then sauteed it. And I used olive oil to saute it in. And you want to get one side crispy before you turn it over and then do the other side. And then when you're finished, you're going to sprinkle some tamari over the tofu in the pan and put on a little bit of the hot chili oil. If you have any of sriracha sauce around or what else do I use? You know, sometimes I just have like some hot sauces around, and I wanted to make the tofu a little spicy, so you can also add anything like that that you have around. And then I squeezed a little lime on it as well, and that was really good. Then I removed the tofu and the tempeh from the pan and laid it out on some paper towel just to absorb some of the oil. So to prepare the sandwiches, you want to toast the whole grain baguette first so it's nice and crunchy and warm. Spread the mayonnaise on both sides, lay out the tofu, put the slaw on top, the cucumber, the cilantro, grind some freshly ground pepper on top of it, and then enjoy. And that's it. It's really easy to do. It looks beautiful, and it's so satisfying. So I hope you all give that a try. And so now I can invite my guest, Stephen Brooks, on. And, you know, he came to me actually through a couple different paths. I first heard of Stephen when my daughter traveled through Costa Rica as a high school student, so that was many years ago. She did an eco-adventure in Costa Rica, and they spent 1 week at this eco-village called Punta Mona. And then last year I had an intern here who said she did a permaculture course at a wonderful place in Costa Rica called Punta Mona. So that was two, you know, people that I really cared about telling me how incredible this place was. So I knew that I had to get in touch with Stephen and invite him on. So I'll let him tell you more about Punta Mona, which is a wonderful eco-village that he established back in 1995. And Stephen, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear
Great.
Me?
Great. Yes, I can. So why don't you first start telling everybody about what Punta Mona is and how you came to live in Costa Rica. I mean, where are you originally from?
I grew up in Miami, North Miami. Actually, I was born in New York, but moved in when I was 8 months. It was a tough move, but I did it.
Uh-huh.
And, yes, I grew up in Miami and came to just on vacation to Costa Rica in 95. And fell in love with the country, the beauty of just the people and rainforests and the beaches and the rivers. It was just, I was super impressed, the people especially. And then one day decided to go check out a town called Bribri. And Bribri is the administrative center of the indigenous Bribri people. And it's interesting. The indigenous tribe is called Bribri. Their main town is called Bribri, and they speak Bribri.
Really?
And, so we decided to go to the town of Bribri, and as you're driving there, you come over this hill of just incredible jungle and beautiful thatch huts along. It's such a beautiful scenery, and then you come around this corner, and as far as my eye could see were banana plantations. And I just remember feeling, whoa, what, like almost like it was a mirage, like looking back, what happened to all that beauty? And then decided to actually drive into the plantation just because I was very curious. I couldn't believe it. And then all of a sudden, out of the corner of my eye, I watched a plane almost seeming like it was going to crash with a big stream of smoke behind it. And I realized that it was a crop duster. Like, it was literally 2 feet above the bananas. And it was a crop duster, went right over my car. My eyes and my face began to burn. And then I watched it fly right over a playground full of indigenous children playing soccer.
Oh, God.
And it was such a, like, it was a jolt to my reality. I couldn't even believe, and started to think, how could this be happening? Who is responsible for this? How could this be going on? I mean, at this day and age, you know, we could video chat with Australia. I mean, we could zip around the world on a jet, you know, and be across the world in half a day. And meanwhile, people don't even know it, but we buy these, you know, commercial bananas, Chiquita bananas or Dole bananas, and meanwhile, they're doing this to these children. And as I really thought about who's responsible for it, I realized that I was responsible for it. Every single day that I would slice my Chiquita bananas into my cinnamon life cereal in the morning as a child, that I was voting for Chiquita. I was voting for Dole. I was voting for this, for them to spray children with chemicals. And the reality is that every time we support any company, we are voting for the way they do business. We're voting for the way they treat the land. We're voting for the way they treat their workers. So it was a real, you know, on one hand, I felt angry and upset with the way, you know, my culture was spreading, you know, this awful way of doing things, you know, and I felt really bummed about it. But I also, for the first time, felt really empowered, like, wow, you know, what I do really matters. What I buy really matters. And my decisions really matter, and I'm going to start really, really becoming conscious about the company that I support. So that was the beginning of just a long road. And then I just started to think, you know, what can I possibly do about it? So I started a tour company bringing high school students down from the States with the goal to show them how beautiful Costa Rica was, but to also show the reality of this, you know, rainforest destruction, the reality of the indigenous cultural decimation, the reality of this multinational agricultural business that's wreaking havoc around the world. And then I wanted to show solutions, and that's where Punta Mona came about. Not knowing anything about anything, I just knew there was a better way to do things, a better way to farm, a better way to interact with your food, a better way to treat people that work for you, treat people that are, you know, around you. And that's basically what Punta Mona is. It's been an experiment in trying to live as lightly as we can while really respecting everyone that's there.
Mm-hmm. And so where is Punta Mona? Is it in that Bribri area? Or?
Yeah, the area, exactly. It's so Punta Mona is on the southern Caribbean coast of Costa Rica. Costa Rica is in Central America, so it has the Pacific side and the Caribbean side. We're on the Caribbean side, which is the east side, on the southern, right, I mean, we're right on the Panama border on the southern Caribbean. The nearest town is called Puerto Viejo, which is a very cool, quaint,
I was there a few years ago, and we wanted to come visit Punta Mona, but they said you had to take a boat, right? You couldn't get there.
Exactly. That's the interesting thing, is there's no road to get there. So this was 1995, long before green was a color, long before it was so hip to be eco, and there was cool radio shows like this in New York. We were located off the grid. So there was, when there's no road to get there, there was no services. All of a sudden, we had to start catching our own water and digging a well. And we also, all of a sudden, we needed to, you know, we got solar panels and started, you know, producing electricity. And having no supermarkets, we really had to create our own by collecting, you know, edible plants and fruit and tropical fruits. And then shortly after, I got into permaculture, which drastically changed the way I thought.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about permaculture.
So permaculture comes from two words, permanent and culture. The term was coined by a guy named Bill Mollison in the early 1970s, and he was from Tasmania, Australia. And basically, it's an ecological design system to create human settlements, and which sounds very vague. My description of it is, how can we meet our goals and use less energy? Which is kind of like a duh. Of course, we'd all want to do that. And then when we break it down, like, what are our goals? Like, as human beings, most of us, when you talk about a macro scale, we pretty much all have the same goals, you know? We want to play more than we work. We want to live somewhere pretty or beautiful. We want to be surrounded by people we love. We want to eat well. And then, so how can we do that and use less energy? And then breaking down what I mean by energy, you know, often, you know, what comes to mind is like electricity. But as humans, we have certain energies. We have physical energy, you know, the physical energy to do things. We have mental energy, the ability to understand and to, you know, reason. And then we have, you know, a big driver of our path is our financial energy. Can we afford to do something? And then what permaculture brings into the equation, you know, and these are things in our decision-making process that are just like, they happen subconsciously. You know, it's like when you decide to do something, obviously you're thinking, can I physically do it? Can I mentally do it? Can I afford to do it? And then what permaculture brings into the equation is, how is doing it going to affect the planet, and can I do it, meet my goals, and affect it in a negative way less? So permaculture is about intention, being very intentional about what you're doing. And permaculture, often people think, is like a gardening design, you know, a gardening technique. Permaculture is a philosophy which, yeah, can pertain to gardening, but it's also, you know, how can we design our own lives so we can be clear what our goals are and get there as, in the most direct path as possible.
Mm-hmm. It sounds, you know, similar to biodynamics in a certain way.
Well, it's not similar. It's not really similar at all, because biodynamics is an agricultural technique that was, you know, brought together by Rudolf Steiner, and it's an agricultural technique. Permaculture is a philosophical design system. Where biodynamics is directly describing agricultural techniques, permaculture is philosophy. I mean, you can be the most amazing permaculturalist and be an accountant, you know, and never even have a garden.
Uh-huh, right. Right, I see.
So, and then permaculture, what it's become now is that there's these, you know, 3-2, 3-4 week courses where you learn about all of these different, you know, sustainable techniques of living, and you learn about, you know, different ways of doing things. Meanwhile, you're living, you know, with 20, 30, 40 people in a ecological community. So you're physically living it, you know, learning the techniques. Meanwhile, you're living in a way where most people haven't lived that way, where you sit together and eat together and do things in ways where the collective whole is managing the resources of the situation.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you first went to Costa Rica and you, you know, found the area that you wanted to start Punta Mona, did you have to purchase that land, or were you allowed to just establish a community there?
Oh, no, we purchased the land, and, you know, it was extremely cheap, and the reason why is because there's no road. Anyone with any amount of money wouldn't want to live where there's no road. And don't get me wrong, it was extremely, extremely challenging. It was not easy to establish what we did. The first many, many years was extremely difficult. I mean, even just now in the last, you know, several years, is it becoming, you know, more comfortable than ever and more accessible to more kinds of people. You know, before it was like the rugged student that could come. And now more and more, you know, we're receiving, you know, all kinds of people.
But they still have to get there by boat.
You still have to, well, you either get there by boat or hiking. We actually recommend people for the first time when they come to actually hike in, and then we bring their bags in by boat.
Uh-huh.
But the hiking is a primary rainforest along the coast, which there's not many places left in the world that have beautiful, you know, coastlines and beaches with primary rainforest.
I did hike through that rainforest. It was beautiful, but I didn't know I could hike straight to Punta Mona there.
Yeah, yeah. If you do it hard and direct without a guide, like you're just trying to get there, point A to point B, it's about an hour and 15 minutes.
Oh, we walked at least for that. We could have gone. Next time. It is a wonderful country. I was so impressed. Really loved it.
It really is. Well, it's really nice knowing that your taxes don't support military and don't support... You know, Costa Rica has 93% renewable energy. As a matter of fact, as we speak right now, I'm overlooking Lake Arenal, which is one of the big sources of electricity, the hydro plant on the Arenal River.
Mm-hmm.
I wish you could see through my eyes, by the way.
I wish I could, too. It's so beautiful there.
Well, I'm at such a beautiful farm right now.
In Arenal?
In Arenal, yeah. It's called Rancho Margot. Very, very nice.
Uh-huh.
My parents are actually here visiting, so we're on a little trip.
Oh, that's nice. Wonderful. So over the years, being at Punta Mona, how has it changed? I mean, you know, you're talking a little bit about, more access and more people coming, but do you have a community of people that live there full-time, or is it mostly you and your partner?
You know, you had started talking about, Punta Mona is not an eco-village, which we have started another eco-village. Punta Mona is an education center. And what I would call it, I'd call it a revolving community. It's constantly changing. The faces that are there, my wife and I run it. And, sometimes we have people that stay for a year or 2 years. But then we have, people that are constantly coming for retreats. And so it is a community in the sense that, we all live together, but it's constantly changing. Ways that it's absolutely changed is I am absolutely obsessed with fruit trees and edible tree-producing food. And so over the years, we've created huge forests, areas where, you would literally think you're in a forest, yet it's all intentional food-producing plants. And so our diet has become, when I first moved there, I ate fish, yuca, and plantains almost every day. Fish that we caught offshore, and plantains and yuca that we grew right there. And
mm-hmm.
It was like bubble gump style. We ate it in every possible way. I mean, every fish cake, yuca, fritters, plant patacones, fried plantains. We ate it every different way. One day, a friend of mine gave me a stick, and he goes, "Yeah, stick this in the ground. It'll come back, and it produces an edible green. It's called chaya, or here in Costa Rica, they call it chikasquil." And it was a day that changed my life because basically this guy just gave me a stick, and that stick drastically changed my life because all of a sudden I had fish, yuca, plantains, and unlimited steamed greens. I made it my mission to find as many sticks and as many plants out there that can improve life. But that stick drastically improved my life within 3 weeks. You plant it, and all of a sudden it's, exploding with edible leaves.
Mm.
So now Punta Mona has such an incredible collection of useful plants. And I consider myself, if I had to label myself as an ethnobotanist, and ethnobotany is the study of the relationship between human beings and plants. And it's so fascinating, we've become so detached from this deep relationship that we have with the plants that we use and the plants that we serve and that serve us and improve our lives. And so I'm really excited about plants and collecting plants and then spreading plants to help improve other people's lives.
Mm-hmm. While you've been there, have you been able to make any improvements on, what you first witnessed of the Chiquita banana plantation and the spraying of the chemicals? Have you raised awareness there at all? Because that was one thing that I was really surprised about, too. There's one vegetarian restaurant that I went to in Puerto Viejo that was, nice, but at the same time, the person that ran the restaurant really did not know about the preservatives or the pesticides that were on different things. So she didn't understand the importance of organic she was making juices and using Welch's grape juice as one of the bases for the juices. And I was like, that just doesn't make sense. And so, I was trying to...
What I think,
go ahead.
The thing that I'm doing is that we work with all the local schools come out to our farm, and hopefully that's impacting them. We also work with a lot of the schools from San Jose. Like one of the kind of treats like, you know, primo private schools in San Jose. Like, I've had the children of the president of Dole at Punta Mona before. You know, I don't hold back. I mean, I really radically speak truth about what's happening to our land and to our food system. And, yeah, I think you know, these things that were, you know, these changes that are happening around us, you know, are real, and they're happening quickly. And sometimes it's really, it was really great listening to the, you know, I was on hold listening to the beginning of your show. And I can't, so this is on in Long Island. I mean, this is such an exciting thing to know that people in Long Island have a radio show like what you, the stuff that you're telling about Keystone Pipeline and just the things that you were sharing and the recipes and the fact that there's enough market to create a radio show discussing the things that you're discussing gives me so much hope.
Right.
You know, so would you say your radio show is changing Long Island to eat better? And to think, yes. I mean, are there tangible things that you could say, oh, this many people are now? No, I mean, it's hard to gauge the impact that we have.
Right.
But all we can keep doing is the best we can and being the best example that we can be ourselves and be as, you know, hopefully as loud and as articulate and reach people in ways that they can relate to. You know, once we become too radical and judgmental, which often our movement, you know, we become very judgmental and, oh, I can't believe that you eat that, or, you know. I think the more compassion and then the more, you know, the ways that we can find to make people feel empowered but also really want to change. Like, I remember when the big announcement that Walmart was selling organic and everybody, oh, my God, organic's ruined. I mean, I felt the opposite. I felt it's great that there's enough market. Walmart doesn't care about organic. Walmart cares what the consumer wants, you know, and the fact that enough consumers are wanting organic that Walmart needs to sell it means we're winning, you know, we're growing.
Yeah, except the other side of it, as I'm sure you're aware of, is that then Walmart pushes to weaken the organic standards and to rip off the farmers and to push them so that they have to sell it for less than they can really afford to sell it. And, you know, Walmart has a whole downside to it, as you can imagine. So, you know, I see both sides of it. Yes, I'm glad that more people want it, and I want to make it accessible to more people. But
I don't want to start shopping at Walmart, but what I do know is that we're growing and we're strong.
Right.
And as, you know, it's like Monsanto's going to win as long as we're, you know, a bunch of hippies in the woods. But as we become, you know, people that are, you know, are engaged in society and engaged in change, and, you know, Monsanto could pay the best marketers and the best PR people. And until we become strong enough to, you know, compete with them, which is what we need to do. We need to be better than the way things are. We need to make it affordable, and we need to educate that, you know, eating healthy is a lot cheaper than the medical costs later on. You know, I think I have so much hope and I have so much faith in the direction that things are going. I really do.
Mm-hmm. Well, Stephen, don't go anywhere. We're going to take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, I want to talk about some of the other things that you are so involved in, like the eco-villages, which we really didn't really touch on yet. So, everyone, don't go away. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and we'll be right back with you. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Stephen Brooks, the founder of Punto Mono Educational Village in Costa Rica. And in addition to founding the Punto Mono Educational Center, Stephen also has his hands in so many other things, and that's what I want to talk to him about right now. Stephen, are you back with us?
I'm right here.
Great. So in addition to founding Punta Mona, which is your educational center, you've also created a couple eco-villages. Can you tell us about those and what your dream was to get that going?
Well, you know, as I was at Punta Mona, I knew that as much as I love it, I knew it wasn't the place to live long term. It wasn't the place to raise my children. It wasn't the place, you know, as my parents got older, it was, you know, the wanting to come less and less. Well, not my dad, but my mom. And so I started to really think about, you know, how could, and it's also within a wildlife refuge, so I wouldn't want to build many more buildings there. So I started seeking out land to create an eco-village. And I also wanted to be closer to San Jose. And so that's where La Eco Villa, LA Eco Villa, was born. And actually 2 nights ago, we had our first homeowners meeting, and I had tears in my eyes. We sold about 26 of the 40 lots. And of those 26 lots, we have 17 countries represented. And what everybody has in common is that they want to see an improved world. They want to eat organic food. We're actually building a school right on the property for our children. There's a retreat center being built on it, and the property when we bought it was like a cow pasture with some fruit trees that was, you know, really overgrown. And we created the lots, and the roads are made from recycled plastic grates. It's called Garden Grid. It's this amazing road alternative. All of our septic, it goes into a methane digester, which produces methane for the kitchens around the property for cooking. We right away brought, you know, permaculture design, so all the roads are just lined with food. Under Costa Rican law, we legally had to make the road 8 meters wide or 25 feet wide, and we took 9, so we only made it 16 feet wide, the road, and then we took 9 feet and made that a green belt all along the entire 1.2 kilometers of road within the property, and that's all growing food. So you drive in, and there's fruit trees, and this perennial bean called pigeon pea, gondolas. There's, you know, rows of pineapples and bananas and sugarcane all along the road as you drive in. And instead of, you know, where most plant communities, what do they have at the center, like this, you know, cheesy clubhouse or a golf course? We did a, you know, giant greenhouses and communal gardens, and we have a saltwater pool and, you know, a yoga space, and then another meeting space. And it's just unbelievable. We've done zero marketing for the project. I mean, this is probably one of the first kind of public announcements of it right here. We've kind of been on the DL about it, and it's just unbelievable because, meanwhile, most of the developments down here in Costa Rica are going bankrupt. You know, the second home market's finished, and, you know, with the turn in the economy. Yet, we don't sell lots to people that are looking for second homes. Like, we're looking for community. And after this meeting the other day, just looking around the room, it was so inspiring to see, you know, and, like, we went around and everybody kind of said, well, like, what brought them to this? Like, what were the aha moments and what changes occurred that made people want to leave the lives that they're coming from to live like this? And it was really beautiful. The majority of the people are Costa Rican, which is a very big shift in the development side. A lot of these developments, you know, they did all the marketing in the state, so they're these like 100% U.S., you know, little gated communities. And that is what we did not want. We don't want to come to Costa Rica and bring our culture and our customs. Instead, we wanted to really mesh with the way things are here, and it's really inspiring to see this happening. I mean, it's really on.
Sounds great. So does it also have a communal, like, you know, not clubhouse, but a place where you can have community events where everybody could have a meal together?
Absolutely, yeah, and an amazing outdoor kitchen and barbecue and, you know, there's a pool, so there's like the pool, this large pool house next to it, and then there's a huge yoga studio with the view. It's really exciting. And, you know, we really just started sales November of last year, and like I said, with zero marketing, because if you start marketing too much, any random person might show up. It's really been done through word of mouth, friends of friends.
And are you selling lots? Are you selling lots with houses on them already, or just lots and people build their own house?
Yeah, the people build their own houses, and the lots range between like a quarter and three quarters of an acre. But when you buy your lot, you become a shareholder in the corporation which owns all the communal lands. And then the best thing about the property, what really drew me to it, is it's on this river called the Machuca River, which has crystal clear pools that you can dive off boulders in and drink the water as you swim. I mean, it's out of like a dream. You feel like you're in Lord of the Rings or something.
But now, if you were to live there, how long will it take you to get to Punta Mona? That's a schlep.
Well, it's pretty far. My vision, you know, I'm recently married as of 2 years ago, family on the horizon, and I always said I'm not going to have children until I know where I'm going to build their school, and now I know. So, I plan to live there, but still run programs and still do what I do with Punta Mona. Still run several permaculture courses. We have a really great team that's helping to run the place now, and people that have been there for a while. So it's really coming together. Our kind of stepping back of the day-to-day running of Punta Mona, and now focusing on the creation of Ecovilla.
Right. And so then what is the – you have another eco-village too, right, called Tecotal?
Tecotal. Actually, two other ones. One's called Zeta Verde here in the Arenal area. And then Tecotal. So basically, when we started Ecovilla, it ended up – we did it as a condominium, which means that people go in and they actually get title to their lots. To do that costs a lot more money. We made some early on mistakes that were expensive. So the lots ended up becoming more and more expensive that a lot of my close Costa Rican friends and a lot of my friends from the States that I wanted to live with couldn't afford it. So what we did is we went in and bought the land up the street, and rather than break it up legally, like in lots, we basically just put the land under a corporation and then we split up the shares. You think by the importance of telling you this is that I think the most important thing that we can all do is get intentional about where we live and who we live with and how we live. Right now we just go and find an apartment, or we go and we find a house, and who our neighbors are is just irrelevant because we're going to drive anytime we need to go anywhere. My advice would be to figure out where you want to live. I'm certainly not telling everybody to move to Costa Rica because that won't work either. But you figure out where you want to live, and do you want to live in the country? Do you want to live in suburbs? Do you want to live in the city? You know, and who do you want to live with so that you can intentionally make that happen? You know, by creating your neighbors. And it's a lot of people are very, you know, oh, but it's so expensive. Things are a lot cheaper when you do them collectively. I actually know a guy that was living in Manhattan, and him and a group of 15 friends ended up buying this building that had, I forget how many apartments, and their mortgage was less than their past rent. And there were 17 friends living in 17 apartments, and they owned the building that they lived in. So everyone in the building were their friends. I have another friend in Berkeley, California, who did, in a neighborhood, started buying up houses that were neighboring. And now there's 8 houses all in a cluster, and they have shared office space, and they have one pool and a whole huge playground and trampoline for their kids. And every family doesn't have 2 cars. They have 1 truck between all of them in case they need to do something like that. So I think starting to think in ways where rather than just let life, you know, just let life tug us along, can we really intentionally plan the life of our dreams?
Right, communities. You know, community, I so agree with you. Communities are where it's at. You know, the nuclear family model of living in your own little house, not knowing your neighbors, you know, getting in a car, out of car every single time you leave your home, it's just not... it's not conducive to living in a heart space. And when you build community, you know, it's funny, you're talking about, you know, it's a conversation I'm having often with my friends and my community here on Long Island, talking about as we get older and we want to, you know, I don't know that any of us will really retire, but, you know, as we want to make a change, where do we want to go and where... you know, what kind of place, what's important to, you know, someone wants to be able to have a horse. You know, I know I want to be able to have my garden. I know I don't want to be too far from culture, you know, some sort of city. you know, so it's interesting as we put these things together and trying to think about where we'd like to pool our resources. And, you know, that's why I asked about the common space where you could have a meal, because, of course, I, as a natural food chef, I love to cook, and I love to cook for people, and I love... you know, I'm also a slow food chapter leader. I love, you know, the whole conviviality of eating together and making those big meals and bringing people together is just, you know, a part of my life. And, you know, I want to do that more with my friends. And
you know, I think people are fearful of like, being that change, you know, and really, you know, we've kind of just settled for the way things are rather than the way we can create them to be. You know,
right.
Things are how they are. Only because that's how they are, you know, but that doesn't mean that, you know, the minute we are clear what we want, we could do it. And I'm actually working on a book. It's called Break Them Chains, An Urban Couple's Escape from Babylon. And I think that's the hardest part. I don't think figuring out how to, you know, capture, collect water or, you know, install solar or grow food, that's not what's hard. I think the hardest part is getting the courage and getting the faith that we can change this and we can do it now. You know, it's, I think that ability to break them chains, you know, and maybe we don't go to the same, you know, maybe we don't go to Java, Mukti, whatever it's called, yoga studio anymore because we live in a little bit further. You know, maybe things are, you know, we don't have the health food store downstairs from our building, you know, but I really think that when we start living this way, the richness and the wholeness and the beauty of our lives become so deep, you know, once we're able to let go of these, you know, false conveniences that the system is providing us with currently.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I just went 6 weeks without seeing a car. I was just in Punta Mona for 6 weeks without leaving. I didn't touch money or didn't see a car for 6 weeks. And there's absolutely nothing that I miss, you know. Like, occasionally, like, I'd want, like, a cold beer. So, you know, when there was somebody coming from town, I'd say, oh, I just want one cold, dark beer. You know, but, like, there's really nothing that I miss. You know, it's like, it's this unquenchable thirst for happiness that we think there's all these things that we need that will fulfill us.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's wonderful to just to inspire people to work towards creating your dreams, because I agree with you that we can do that, and we can do that wherever we are with the right intention. You know, it seems like you've been able to touch on so many different things in Costa Rica. I wonder if it's easier to make things happen there, because if you're coming with, you know, the energy of an American to a more laid-back area, whether you can get more stuff done at one time. It almost feels that way.
Well, you know, the U.S. isn't so in favor of us living this way. Why? Because then we buy less food, that's less taxes. We buy less things, which is, you know, don't you remember what happened after 9/11? The first thing that Bush said?
Go shopping.
Go shopping. Where's your steak? Well, it's like, so yeah. They make it hard to get permits to put several houses on a piece of land. Why? You know, they want us to live in these cluster houses that are designed in ways. And, you know, I say they. I'm not one of those conspiracy. I mean, I personally don't think there's some, like, Montgomery Burns sitting in some high office and saying, ha, 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 we're in the CDA trapped in jobs that they hate, ha, ha. You know, I just think it's a system that it's time to remove ourselves from. And you know, obviously there's a transition where we still work within it, yet we stop being so dependent on their food. We stop being so dependent on their electricity. We stop becoming so dependent on their water. And we start creating solutions that we can provide those things for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Now, you also founded something called the Sustainable Solutions Caravan. Is that still going, mm-hmm. and what is that?
No, that's not going anymore. That's a funny question. In 2003, I was sitting the week we got internet in Punta Mona, solar-powered satellite internet. And a friend of mine looked at me and he goes, you know, Stephen, this is all really great what you've done with the solar panels and the student groups and the food growing and these beautiful houses made from fallen trees. But how many times a year do you fly back to the States? And I looked at him and I don't know, two, three times a year. I got weddings and stuff. He's like, well, did you know that every time, do you know how much fuel you use every seat on an airplane? You came up with some astronomical number, the amount of fuel that every time you take a three-hour flight. And it hit me. It was like, wow, you're right. So 6 months later, we organized 26 people on two school buses and a truck, and we drove from Berkeley, California to Costa Rica on recycled vegetable oil. And just because we could, you know, it was just because, you know, it's like that's another way we're tricked to believe that we have to, you know, run our cars on gasoline, you know. And meanwhile, like, I had a whole group of hippies that were the mechanics that created this system that we were running on. And you know, now it's become a lot more mainstream. You see a lot of there's biodiesel stations in every city. You can get biodiesel. This was straight vegetable, SVL. And the original diesel engine, Rudolf Diesel, invented the diesel engine to run on peanut oil.
Mm-hmm. amazing, right?
But
I mean, it just shows you how you can, how we don't have to be so dependent on these fossil fuels, but, you know, because it's such a business, they create these illusions that we think that that's what we have to do.
So we did it 2 years. We drove down to Costa Rica 2 years. The second year we did it with 11 people on one school bus. And it was amazing. I mean, there's a show called Primer Impacto, which is like the 2020 of the Spanish-speaking world, hundreds of millions of viewers. And literally, it would stick their micro. They interviewed us in three countries. And they would literally stick their microphone in our face and, what do you want to tell 250 million people? And all I would say is we've got to vote with our pesos. We have to vote with our dollars. We have to become conscious of the companies that we're supporting and the way they're doing business and the way they're treating the workers and the way they're treating the environment. And we need to start now. It was an incredible journey.
Uh-huh. Well, I agree with you. I agree with you. You know, and I had, I don't know if you heard of Winona Howder's new book called Foodopoly. But she's the executive director of Food and Water Watch, and her new book is just talking about how, yes, we have to vote with our dollar, and that's very important, but she was also saying that is not going to be enough when we have all the power of the Monsantos. That's why, you know, I'm organizing this bus to get, you know, hundreds of people down to Washington, D.C., so that we can meet up with thousands and thousands of other people to protest the Keystone Pipeline and to, you know, protest the anti-fracking, because we really, we have to take to the streets like we did, you know, with the anti-Vietnam War, and, you know, let our politicians know, because, and it's going to take a, it's going to take time, but the politicians have to hear the uprising in the streets. To really...
No, and we have to uprise. I agree with you, but we also at the same time have to be that change. We got to stop driving our SUVs. We got to stop using so much fuel. We got to stop flying across the country for meetings. We got to stop flying and driving so much. Like, it's like so, it's so easy to go and wave a sign, you know, and then drive home in your SUV. And you see a lot of that. You know, you see a lot of these, you know, you see a lot of activists that have very loud mouths, yet aren't doing that. You know?
Right. You have to walk the walk. Talk the walk and walk the walk.
Exactly, exactly.
Yes, yes, we do. So so where do you see yourself going, you know, right now, putting most of your energy towards these new eco-villages, or it seems like you're transitioning a little bit away from the Punta Mona. What do you see as your next mission?
I'm the co-producer of a festival called the Envision Festival, envisionfestival.com. Check it out. And again, it's a gathering. This will be our third year. The first year we had about 700 people. Last year we had about 3,000 people. This year we're expecting about 4,500 people. And it's a, you know, it's a festival of yoga and music and workshops.
I was looking at it online. I was drooling. I would love to go.
Please come. It is amazing. I mean, it really is a sick. I mean, we have Julia Butterfly coming this year to speak, and Daniel Pinchbeck, and just some great speakers and workshops. We have Alex Gray, the artist, is coming. He's doing, like, figure drawing workshops, and he's doing live painting. We have an amazing art gallery. So I think it's about creating... it's about creating this new paradigm, whether it's through education centers or whether it's through eco-villages or whether it's through gatherings.
Well,
Stephen,
it certainly sounds like you're doing it there. And if people want to get in touch with you, is the best way through the puntamona.org or your email?
Yeah, any of them. Any. My email is Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N, at puntamona.org.
Or the website is puntamona.org. And everybody, thank you, Stephen, so much for joining us. You're an inspiration. Keep up the great work.